The following program is a production of the North Carolina Reading Service, intended for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week, the Independence, and I'm John Feddersen here to read this week's issue, which is dated April the 10th of 2025. And we fade down our music and we fade me up. And to get started, to City of Raleigh, Mayor Janet Cowell is previewing now the city budgets. Of all the things local government does, passing a budget each year is one of the most complex and bureaucratic. In Raleigh, city staff and elected officials spend months maneuvering through a series of requests, drafts, work sessions, and hearings to arrive at a 400-page document laden with an alphabet soup of acronyms. The process may be somewhat inscrutable to a layperson, but it's consequential. The city funds transit, parks, public safety, social programs, water and solid waste services, and quite a bit more, and all those spending choices impact residents' property taxes and quality of life. Right now, Raleigh's city manager, Marshall Adams David, and her staff are putting together a budget proposal for the coming fiscal year. Meanwhile, the mayor and city council are meeting periodically for budget work sessions to get updates and provide feedback on a few topics of special public interest, like separation allowance for firefighters, for example. Residents will get to share their thoughts about the budget at a public hearing in June, and the council must adopt a budget by the end of that month. With the season well underway, the Indy asked Raleigh Mayor Janet Cowell to distill her top priorities for the next city budget. A veteran of the city council and a former state treasurer, Cowell is fluent in the language of municipal finance, and here's what she told us to expect from the next budget and how it will affect residents. First, there won't be a significant property tax increase this year. Cowell says, we know people have had a lot of tax increases in past years at rates that are not sustainable. And we also know the election turned on cost of living to some extent, and so are very cognizant that we do not want to dramatically increase the budget. The city budget for the current fiscal year is $1.4 billion. That's a 12% increase over the previous fiscal year. Homeowners paid higher property taxes this year compared to last, following county property revaluations. That's a consistent trend over the past few years. Cowell says this year residents might see a slight increase consistent with inflation, but nothing dramatic. She says, I just don't think there's an appetite on the council's part or the citizens for the kinds of tax increases you've seen. Next, don't expect many new programs either. Cowell says in the current inflationary period, costs have gone up steeply across the board. In order for the city to keep tax rates relatively stable, it needs to implement some belt-tightening measures and eliminate some vacant positions. She says it's stunning how much everything has gone up. Part of that is real estate values have gone up so much in Wake County that your acquisition cost of any piece of land is astronomically more expensive. But then you look at materials, labors, everything, and that's making it really challenging to undertake big new projects. I don't think you're going to see a lot of big new anything. It's going to be completing existing projects, continuing existing services. For a budget to reflect the city's current priorities without increasing substantially, the mayor says she wants to shift some existing staff onto new projects. She intends to create a specialized team that focuses on tax credit projects for affordable housing and another dedicated to green infrastructure. Cowell's primary focus is paying city workers competitively. One area the city will be investing more resources is staff salaries. Raleigh hired a consulting firm to conduct a compensation study, and they found that city workers are underpaid compared to the market average. The pay disparity leads to vacancies, problems with retention, and gaps in service. Cowell says, paying city staff may not be sexy for folks who reside in the city, but I think they do want to know those vacancies get filled. What that study found was our employers are paid 14% below market, and Raleigh is an attractive place to be, so we have been able to hire and retain, but it's still not sustainable. She wants to see pay raises across the board for city workers. She's emphasized in the past the importance of paying police and firefighters competitively, and she told Indy she's also paying special attention to departments like code enforcement and permitting. Those workers, she says, have a direct impact on our ability to get housing on the ground and deliver projects. I definitely want to shore up those salaries. What about Trump's tariffs? Well, they likely will not impact this budget. She expects the full force of tariffs to hit in the next budget cycle, not this one. For the time being, Cowell said, the city's focused on defending the money we're getting from the feds. Most of the federal funding Raleigh receives right now is for rail projects and bus rapid transit. Finally, does Raleigh need all this bureaucracy? Cowell has been reading Abundance by journalists Derek Thompson and Ezra Klein, and it's got her thinking about how to pare Raleigh's morass of rules and regulations. The book posits that in order to escape the current era of polarization and government mistrust, Democrats in power need to eschew cumbersome regulations and take on ambitious public projects. Cowell says, I'm trying to think through, are there bite-sized pieces at the city level where you could start to try to start extracting yourself from this thicket of bureaucracy? There are areas of the city's work where a slower, more cumbersome process is inevitable, she says, especially where the state or federal government is involved. But on the local scale, she's looking for areas where Raleigh can, quote, keep it simpler and to make more headway. And another from Raleigh. Arthur and Anya Gordon, the founders and former owners of Irregardless Cafe, just moved one step closer to realizing their dream of creating an affordable housing development anchored by their community garden in southwest Raleigh. On Tuesday morning, Raleigh Planning voted 5-3 in favor of the Gordons' request to rezone their 2.5-acre Athens Drive property for mixed-use development. The Gordons envision an apartment building that houses a mix of older residents, families, and solo tenants who share the responsibility of maintaining a garden on the property. The couple hopes to sell the property to a nonprofit developer who would build according to their specifications. Arthur Gordon had previously explained to Indy that for him and Anya, this project is, quote, more than a rezoning. It's about creating community and celebrating nature, the same principles that led them to open Irregardless in 1975. And Arthur told the Planning Commission, the key piece for my wife and I is that the garden becomes the focus so the people have something to do that puts them in the shared space. The council will hear the rezoning case, City Council, and make the final decision to approve or deny. If the rezoning is approved, the Gordons or a future owner will be empowered to build a three-story development with up to 67 residential units and some ground floor retail space. Arthur first petitioned the Planning Commission to grant this last month. The commissioners praised his creativity and the prospect of adding affordable, gentle density near Athens Drive Magnet High School, but they also expressed concerns that a developer might stray from the Gordons' original plan. In response, the couple revised their proposal to prohibit certain types of development on site, including restaurant, outdoor sports facility, cemetery, or convenience store. As evidenced by their split vote, the commissioners have lingering concerns about the Gordons' request even after that modification. During their Tuesday meeting, they asked Arthur why there weren't affordable housing conditions embedded in the request, if that is his intent for the property. He responded he didn't want to create too many limitations in case the plan for the property evolves. Commissioners also questioned him about setbacks between a future apartment complex and the surrounding single-family homes. That's a sticking point they encouraged him to revisit before the city council takes up that request. Commissioner Tolulope Okumayaye, one of the no votes, said, "This vision is amazing, but once you sell the property, anything can happen." Despite that warning, optimism prevailed among the commissioners, if only by a slim majority. Commissioner Roberta Fox said the Gordons' idea has the potential to be a model for Raleigh. The couple will have another chance to modify their request if they wish before the city council votes on it in the coming weeks. Over to Durham. Now, the city of Durham will put its first round of opioid settlement funds towards harm reduction and mobile treatment. They're poised to allocate nearly $1 million to support organizations on the front lines of the opioid crisis. That funding stems from a nationwide settlement agreement between state governments and the giant pharmaceutical manufacturers and distributors like McKesson and Johnson & Johnson, who were held responsible for their role in the opioid epidemic. Attorneys general across the country, including now Governor Josh Stein, brought cases against the drug companies, accusing them of exacerbating the opioid epidemic. That litigation has culminated in over $26 billion being awarded to state and local governments across the U.S., with more funding potentially being awarded as future litigations against companies like Purdue is settled. In the initial settlement, North Carolina received $1.4 billion, which will be distributed to local municipalities over 18 years, from 2022 to 2038. Local governments that receive payouts are required to report how they distribute the money, and the city of Durham is set to receive $4.5 million total over this 18-year period. Additionally, Durham County will receive $21.7 million over that same period. At a work session last week, the Durham City Council awarded their first round of payouts to three groups following the RFP process, which concluded last November. Lincoln Community Health Center is poised to receive an estimated $400,000+. The long-standing community hospital will invest the funds in its medication-assisted treatment, MAT, program by expanding operations at its main clinic on Fayetteville Street, its Lakewood Satellite Clinic, and its Health Care for the Homeless site. Durham Technical Community College would receive $240,000. Which the school plans to use toward Project MAPS, that's Mobile Addiction Treatment and Primary Service, a collaboration between Durham Tech College, Duke Health, and the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition that provides mobile treatment units for afflictions like HIV and hepatitis C throughout the community. The funding will support improving mobile lab equipment needed for lab work and testing, as well as additional staff. Additionally, the Durham Community Safety Department will receive $267,000 to hire a peer support specialist who would serve as a harm reduction coordinator with the HEART team, H-E-A-R-T. The funding will also allow HEART to expand their safe syringe program and provide additional recovery support service. The initial contract for this opioid settlement funding is for 3 years. Funding will not be officially released until the council approves its consent agenda at the city council meeting, well, that was held on March the 17th. Opioid addiction, as a background, has ravaged the country for years. A recent uptick in drug overdose deaths due to proliferation of fentanyl, and a much stronger than oxycodone or street drugs like heroin, has brought the fight front and center. North Carolina alone experienced a 22% increase in drug overdose deaths in 2019 to 2021. A number of agencies are working to intervene in the cycles of addiction and improve health outcomes for Durham residents. Durham Tech Community Health Lab, CHL, has been providing health care access to members of underserved communities in Durham and Orange counties since 2020. In 23, they partnered with Duke Health and the North Carolina Harm and Reduction Coalition to create this project MAPS, which provides, quote, evidence-based medication-assisted treatment for opioid disorder, primary care services, and comprehensive harm reduction, including naloxone for overdose prevention and syringe services. Whitney Young, a community health lab coordinator at Durham Tech, has been leading the program since its inception, and she says the health lab is an opportunity for the school to further entrench itself in the communities it serves. Quote, Durham Tech has community in the name. In our minds, this is a way we could expand our reach in helping the community, but also we'd love to involve our student learners in any way we can, because we want to help shape them to become better empathetic practitioners for the future. Young's team visits regular sites twice a month, encountering an average of 30 individuals in need of health interventions. The lab carries medications, that's drugs used for overdose protection, like naloxone, and other tools to collect samples for further testing. Young says the mobile unit is not currently equipped to run certain tests, but the additional funding from the settlement could go a long way in helping to build out the unit's capabilities. Many agencies are concerned about losing access to federal funding as it becomes increasingly less reliable, thanks to Elon Musk's slash-and-burn approach as the architect behind the newly formed Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, DOGE. At the same CityWorks session where the council agreed to move forward on deploying settlement funding, folks affected by the halting of foreign aid funding were in attendance, asking the council to join them in publicly decrying the funding cuts. For the CHL team, finding funding sources is a weekly agenda item, regardless of who is in office. About half the patients who are served by Project MAPS are insured through Medicaid, Young says, and another 40% are uninsured. CHL is able to provide free prescriptions through a partnership sponsored by Alliance Health. Loss of coverage for patients due to cuts to Medicaid, which have been floated by the Trump administration, would have a major impact on access to treatment and important medications like Suboxone, used to treat opioid dependence. Young said, if we were to see a loss of Medicaid coverage for our folks in North Carolina, programs like ours, other free clinics providing service to the uninsured would be increasingly relied on. The cost of medications, though, would still be a barrier that our patients would have to navigate. More funding from the lawsuits against Big Pharma could provide the city and county with additional resources to invest in programs like CHL and others. Councilmember Nate Baker, who often uses his platform to denounce the billionaire class, like the Sacklers, who owned Purdue Pharma, and are widely considered the main antagonists in the opioid epidemic, said he was thankful to see Durham get the resources it needs to try and combat opioid addiction, one of the country's most severe health challenges. And he said, I think people are so used to billionaires like the Sackler family not only getting away with, but being rewarded for their crimes, it's almost shocking to see a minor semblance of justice served in the form of settlement money distributed to local governments to help stem addiction. Says Baker, billionaires and regular people are punished unequally, and there is not enough money in the world to fully make things right. Nevertheless, these are critical resources, and Durham and our partners will use them well. Now, folks, your reader, John Feddersen, has a bunch of very thick articles, the background articles, and I have gotten more license to, in effect, self-edit what I read to you from the Indie Week. For example, here's one about a lawsuit that was written on the 2nd of March about a deadly indifference at the Orange County Jail, and it runs for 3 pages. I thought I will indicate exactly what the news behind this lawsuit is, but there's no governmental action impending about it that I'll read to you, and there are many details. And I'll just remind everyone that IndieWeek.com is my source for all of these stories. I print them out. And then to make sure I get enough stories in my one-hour broadcast, I do a little bit of trimming and paring like I do not do when we read the News and Observer in a different program. All right, so I will tell you, I'm just going to read a few paragraphs of this so that you at least know about that. It's been 5 years since Tiffany King lost her 34-year-old son. But walking through her Durham home, or take a look at her arms, which are covered with tattoos commemorating her son, and it is as if Maurice King is still here. But one tattoo in particular reminds her that it's not. 22-22, that's military time for exactly when her son died on March the 4th in 2020. At the time, Maurice King was a federal inmate awaiting sentencing for drug charges at the Orange County Jail in Hillsborough. A federal lawsuit his mother filed in 2021 alleges that after another inmate assaulted him, detention officers neglected to check on King for an hour and a half while he suffered in his cell with cuts and bruises on face and struggling to breathe. More than 2 hours passed before he was taken to Duke University Hospital, where he died minutes after arrival, alleges the lawsuit. According to an autopsy report, he died from hypertensive cardiovascular disease after a physical altercation. The mother's initial lawsuit was filed against Orange County Sheriff Charles Blackwood, Orange County, and 9 detention officers. It alleges that Blackwood, who has been in office since 2014, has run a jail in which detention officers routinely buck local policies and state standards on supervising and monitoring inmates. From 2017 to 2020, state inspectors repeatedly cited the sheriff's office for lax supervision and for allowing inmates to use towels, sheets, and other items to make it more difficult for officers to look into their cells. Luke Woolard, an attorney for Disability Rights North Carolina, said jails across North Carolina have similar issues with supervision and monitoring, which has led to deaths, saying the supervision requirements are very clear and are written into the jail administration rules for a reason, because it's one of the main things that helps keep folks safe. Claims against most of those defendants have been dismissed, leaving Blackwood and 2 detention officers as the remaining defendants. Last month, U.S. District Judge Catherine Eagles in Greensboro issued a ruling paving the way for a trial on claims against Blackwood and the other 2. Attorneys for them are appealing the decision to the U.S. Court of Appeals and did not respond to requests for comment. One of the attorneys for the defendants said the trial is on hold while the appeals process plays out. It could be months before the appellate court issues a ruling. That means Tiffany King will just have to keep waiting. And now there are 3 more pages, and it details a minute-by-minute reconstruction of events, as stated in the lawsuit. So, again, suit alleges deadly indifference. That was published on March the 2nd in Indie Week. So it's in a past issue, but these are all online and they're free for you to access if you want to know more. All right, what do I have next? Let's talk about federal cuts for North Carolina libraries. On March 14th, two things happened to America's beloved library system. Hours before a government shutdown would have occurred, the U.S. Senate passed a Republican-led continuing resolution that funds federal services through September. That includes funding for the Institute of Museum and Library Services, IMLS. That same day, President Trump issued an executive order calling for the elimination of, quote, non-statutory components and functions in seven small federal agencies. IMLS is among them. Like so many of the others, testing the bounds of executive authority issued in the flurry of President Trump's first few months in office this term, some elements of the order are unclear, including the status of current grants and what might be deemed statutory functions. He can't eliminate IMLS entirely. Congress established it in 1996, and the administration doesn't have the federal power to axe an independent federal agency that's codified by law. But as we've seen with DOJ's slash-and-burn approach to fiscal reduction, evidenced by mass firings at Consumer Finance Protection, U.S. Agency for International Development, agencies can be gutted to the point of becoming non-functional. The intent to destroy IMLS, which, with a budget of roughly $290 million, makes up less than 3/1000th of 1% of the federal budget, all while yielding massive economic and social impacts, is clear in the executive's order's language. Quote, eliminated to the maximum extent, has been reduced to the minimum presence and function required by law. Dozens of museum and library organizations have staunchly denounced that order, and the American Library Association was quick to issue a statement. Quote, by eliminating the only federal agency dedicated to funding library services, the Trump executive order is cutting off at the knees the most beloved and trusted of American institutions and the staff and services they offer. Shortly after the executive order, the administration appointed Keith E. Sunderland, Trump's recently confirmed Secretary of Labor, as the acting head of the IMLS. In a statement, Sunderland affirmed he was committed to being in lockstep with the administration. He said, we will revitalize MLS and restore focus on patriotism, ensuring we preserve our country's core values, promote American exceptionalism, and cultivate love of country in future generations. A February 27th executive order, quote, restoring truth and sanity to American history, took that patriotism mandate one step further, taking aim at the Smithsonian's vast apparatus, calling out the National Museum of African American History and Culture in particular to claim that it has promoted divisive, race-centered ideology. In that executive order, Trump calls for Vice President J.D. Vance, who serves on the Board of Regents, to, quote, remove improper ideology. The Smithsonian comprises 21 museums, in addition to research centers, libraries, and the National Zoo. All right, this has to do with libraries. They're primarily funded in North Carolina through municipal and county taxes, with some additional funds allotted by the General Assembly and outside donors. These, however, primarily cover the essentials and basic services. Federal grants, like the ones from IMLS, help fund special programming and initiatives. IMLS awarded over $30 million in grant funding to North Carolina between 2020 and 2024. Past awards have gone to projects like bookmobiles, nutritional programs, mental health programming, lactation spaces, funding for baby storytime kits, and digital hotspots. Many of these grant-funded initiatives were concentrated in rural communities. Last year, in 2024, the state was awarded over $2.5 million through IMLS Library Service and Technology Act, LSTA. These grants were dispersed to 41 libraries in a broad range of amounts across the library system. Local libraries now face a limbo period regarding the administration of future grant-funded programs. The largest grant to a North Carolina library, over $800,000, was awarded to UNC Chapel Hill's North Carolina Digital Heritage Center, a program run out of the Wilson Library that helps digitize statewide material like images, city directories and records, among other historical ephemera, and make them searchable. The program, the state's hub for the Digital Public Library of America, began in 2017. Staff did not respond to requests for comments about whether the program's duration or personnel will be affected by IMLS cuts. You can navigate to the North Carolina Digital Heritage Center website to type in a historic term, and the website draws up a massive newspaper repository from across the state. And the author of this is, I typed in Wilmington, 1898, and found articles, some naming the historical event as a coup, others dating back to 1902, wielding obscenely racist language, that painted a broad picture of how that event, that is to say that massacre in Wilmington in 1898, is being framed over time. UNC's Greensboro Digital Library on American Slavery likewise received funding for digitization efforts, $100,000 for the library's People, Not Property, Slave Deeds project, a collaboration between multiple state cultural heritage offices to expand its searchable database of tens of thousands of slave deeds collected. While a project like People Not Property might not engender Sonderling's goal to cultivate love for country, it does substantially deepen scholarship about the state's history and make it possible for African-American families to trace their family lineage. The smallest LSTA grant, $5,000 earmarked for the Southern Pines Public Library, goes toward a dementia and memory care kit collection. In the Triangle, $40,000 went to the Maker Plus Steam, STEAM Services Program, and $45,000 grant disbursed to Chapel Hill Public Library Chapel Hill Descendants Project. Like the Greensboro Initiative, the Descendants Project explores ancestral connections to enslavement in the Chapel Hill area. Across the country, many libraries and museums have issued calls for support in response to the executive order targeting IMLS. Spokespeople for both Chapel Hill and Durham libraries that Indy contacted issued careful responses to interview requests. Laura Brown, Assistant Director of Chapel Hill Library, wrote over email, quote, "The bulk of our budget comes from the town of Chapel Hill in Orange County," clarifying that the library does not receive ongoing IMLS funding. "We have received grants in the past for short-term projects like the Descendants and are grateful for the special initiatives we were able to support through this funding. We don't have anything more to share at this time." Stephanie Bonestell, Public Relations for Durham County Libraries, wrote, "The library has not applied for any LSTA grants for the next year." She wrote, "We are awaiting information on how potential federal cuts to IMLS may affect our library system from the State Library of North Carolina and Durham County government. Despite these uncertainties, our library remains committed to serving our patrons with the resources available." Last week, at the long-awaited opening of Carborough's well-outfitted Drakeford Library, Mayor Pro Tem Danny Nowell offered a bluntly jubilant appraisal of the government's role in supporting libraries. He said, they want us to think this is not possible. They want us to think we can't build this for each other. They want us to think that government doesn't do this. We're sitting at the end of a 40-year project, and it lifts my spirits. So thank you, and let's fight for more of it. All right, let's go over to Durham again. At Catawba Trail Farm, the main crop is self-reliance, writes Courtney Lewis, and this was put in Indy Week on the 7th of April. On a recent Saturday, a group of volunteers gathers in a field of northern Durham. Squinting against the wind, adjusting their hats and tightening their coats, they pull on gloves and head into the woods, away from the clucks of chickens. And volunteer Lilton Evans Jr. says, there's history in these trees, gazing upward into the canopy of trees at the Catawba Trail Farm. The volunteers are here to put in a day's work at the farm, a farm and educational center in northern Durham. These days, Catawba Trail focuses on building skills of self-reliance through offering space for growing crops and teaching farming skills. Those lessons all take place on the site that was once part of one of North Carolina's largest plantations. Catawba Trail Farm is home to Urban Community Agronomics, UCAN is the acronym, a nonprofit organization founded in 2016 by Delphine Sellers and Lucille Patterson to provide North Durham residents access to fresh fruits and vegetables. A gravel trail leads to the heart of the program, the long rows of seedlings and greenery that make up the farm's community garden. Tucked into the 176-acre farm just west of the Little River, the community garden boasts 47 raised beds bursting with collard greens, tomatoes, potatoes, and other crops, which vary depending on the season. Some beds are tended by community members who rent the growing space and take home their harvest. Others are taken care of by UCAN staff who donate the produce to people in need. The farm hosts free produce giveaways once each month in partnership with Farmer Food Share and Carolina Farm Stewardship Association. Community members who show up get a complimentary box of locally grown produce. In addition to giving away produce, the farm's Green Bucket program provides buckets, soil, fruits, and vegetables so people can grow their own produce at home. The farm also hosts on-site farmers markets, selling produce and eggs from Catawba Trail and other local farms. For sellers who grew up on a vegetable farm in Washington, North Carolina, the farm is a continuation of her life's work. She says, I wouldn't change my childhood and my growing up and my teenage years and in that hot sun and chopping and all that kind of stuff, growing vegetables. She moved to Durham to attend North Carolina Central, becoming a first-generation college graduate. Despite her change in scenery, her connection to agriculture never faltered. She says, it's amazing how you come full circle, but everywhere I went, I always had a flower garden. Then, when I moved to Durham, I actually had a garden in my yard, and then, you know, through working with the county and being county extension director, it came back. I learned a lot. As the former Durham County Community Outreach Coordinator and a former Extension Director, she learned a lot about what her community needs. So I saw people being given food, but it wasn't given with kindness and compassion. I saw people given things, but it wasn't done with the dignity that they deserve simply because they were human beings. As they considered items for their organization, Sellers and Patterson asked how they could have a sustainable impact. Their answer, giving people space to grow their own food helps build resilience. The farm's community is not limited by age, race, gender, or level of gardening interest. Zaytia Collins helps lead youth programs in the farm's youth community garden. On this Saturday, Collins lumbers through the mud to get more safety glasses for the volunteers. On Fridays or Saturdays, Collins can also always be seen, Collins often can be seen planting, painting, giving children tours, feeding chickens, and pulling children on the cart for a trail ride. She started with Catawba Trail in March of 24 while she was a North Carolina Central student, drawn in part by the site's history, saying, "Farming is where we originally came from. I think it's important for us to reclaim what once was originally something we did. And as they grow their food, they're going to come together better as a community," said Sellers. "As they grow their food, they're going to come to appreciate one another. As they grow their food, they're going to love themselves. So it builds up their human spirit, human dignity. But also, once you know how to do something, nobody can take it away from you. Nobody." The farm sits on part of the former Snow Hill Plantation, once one of North Carolina's largest plantations, which was owned and operated by the Cameron family. The Triangle Land Conservancy transferred the 176-acre farm to UCAN in 2024. It's one of the biggest transfers of property to a black-led nonprofit that has ever taken place in North Carolina, according to the Conservancy. "And it's continuing to change," notes Barbara Rumer, another volunteer. As she bends down to grab a log, she says, "It looks a lot different than it did last year." Well, I guess it was 2 years ago. Over the past 2 years, the farm has expanded its nature trail, increased its staff, renovated a mill house for use as an on-site office, grown its number of beehives, and added a high tunnel. That's a greenhouse-like structure covered in plastic that is used to extend fruit and vegetable growing seasons. The group has even released its own cookbook, Recipes from Catawba Trail Farm. Today's volunteers are clearing the way for still more growing space. Through the snarl of the chainsaws, a voice rings out, "Break time!" Rumer, Evans, Collins, and the rest of the volunteers trek through the mud back toward the looming wooden house to gather around a fire. The structure will eventually be turned into the farm's intergenerational house, a hub for history, storytelling, farming, and community. At least, that's the hope. Sellers' dream is for the farm to be a lasting staple for the Durham community, open to all people, saying, "You can come out and you can hear stories at the intergenerational house. You can walk to the trails, to the bank of the river. You can walk through the woods. You can feel peace." From coffee to cocktails, Triangle Cafes serve as a home base for remote workers. One of the best benefits of working from home is the opportunity to choose not to do so. For example, taking your laptop to a local coffee shop for a change of scenery and a fresh drink. And for those stuck at their desks, Raleigh's surplus of top-rated bars makes it easy to find a happy hour spot after a long work day. But what if you could have both amenities at once? Enter the rising number of transitional cafes, dual spaces that serve coffee by day and flip to serving alcohol by night. These have popped up around the Triangle over the last several years. Across the area, these businesses have transformed remote work culture by offering patrons the best of both worlds in an all-in-one package. John Paradiso, who co-owns the Daily Beer Bar in Durham with his wife Rosa, says, "Many of our regulars are folks who work remotely and will come in, work on their laptop and enjoy some coffee and a pastry, and once 5 p.m. rolls around, the laptop will close and they'll order a drink." The convenience of being able to consume a full day's worth of food and beverage at one location is certainly a major factor in why people are drawn to transitional cafes, but it's far from the only reason. With remote and hybrid jobs still popular, that's a study found 26% of American households had at least one member working remotely for one day a week at the minimum. Many people miss the experience of working alongside others. Paradiso puts it simply, folks are looking for community spaces. Since it opened on Main Street in 2022, the Daily Beer Bar has focused on providing such a space. From 8:30 a.m. to noon, guests can enjoy locally sourced pastries and coffees provided by Durham's Yonder Coffee. And in the afternoon, they can lunch on sandwiches and salads before picking up wine or beer to wrap up the day. Laptop use is allowed until the shop's 9 p.m. closing, just not at the main bar. And only if customers avoid overly loud Zoom meetings. Paradiso says, while we definitely have guests who visit us for either coffee or beer, we tend to find most folks come in early, stay for most of the day, and end up experiencing the full spectrum of what the Daily has to offer. In Raleigh, Sir Walter Coffee has been serving up both morning and evening beverages since its 2016 launch on Davie Street. At the time, Kevin Fraser, the owner, says coffee and cocktail bars were few and far between. We decided to create a space that catered to being a social spot with a beverage choice for anyone, whether you want coffee, tea, or beer. Not that you have to choose. One of Sir Walter's unique features is the number of coffee-infused cocktails, like espresso martinis and Hush Money martinis on the menu. The options are even wider at the shop's new Fayetteville Street location, which has a full cocktail bar separate from the coffee counter. Other dual spaces in Raleigh include Nora, N-O-R-A, on Strickland Road, which serves wine and beer in addition to the plethora of coffee drinks. Co-owners Matt and Colleen Gross opened that in 2020 with the goal of creating a space that felt like, quote, a cross between your grandmother's living room, the public library, and the neighborhood pub. Over the years, the couple has stocked Nora with a wide selection of books, artwork, games, and puzzles for customers to peruse when taking a break from their laptops. These are all just things we wanted to have to make the space feel warm, welcoming, and comfortable for a visit of any length. Some entrepreneurs have embraced the trend due to potential financial and logistical benefits. When Joe Choi, owner of Namu in Durham, decided to expand his Korean food truck into The Can Opener, a full space featuring both coffee shop and beer hall, the potential for more revenue was a main factor. He explains, we saw there was an opportunity to expand on the usage of the space without paying for more space. He estimates that since the pandemic, Namu has seen a 25% increase in customers coming in early for coffee while they work and staying until evening to wind down. Over in Cary and Apex, meanwhile, coffee shop brewery Vicious Fishes has established itself as one of each area's foremost transitional cafes, which its co-founders say was always intentional. Ken O'Berry, who opened the first location with Paul Miller in 2019, says, it was evident from the start there was an opportunity to serve the community from dawn to dusk. Indeed, customers use the space for a range of needs all day long, much to the duo's satisfaction. We love serving as the community's living room, where people gather around the day to enjoy business meetings or friendly catch-ups over coffee, beer, wine, cider, and non-alcoholic beverages. All right, how about a recording article by Joe Vanderford, Branford Marsalis. He's no longer a local. Technically, he's still very much around. He remains an instructor and artist in residence at NC Central University, passing the symbolic torch of jazz to Gen Z and beyond. And he's still gigging in town from time to time. Just last month, March 19th, that is, Marsalis was part of a heavenly Vespers service at Duke Chapel, saxophone and piano filling the reverberant abbey with endless notes of grace. But here's the biggest news. The Branford Marsalis Quartet has a new record, its first in 6 years. Released last week on the legendary Blue Note label, Belonging is a crystalline reimagining of the pivotal 1974 album by pianist Keith Jarrett's heralded European Quartet. We played the music exactly as Jarrett wrote it, Marsalis explained over the phone from his new digs in his hometown of New Orleans. We constructed chord changes when they were needed, but it's all based on those original 6 songs. Now, we all know maybe that Marsalis, a former leader of the Tonight Show band, lived in Durham from 2002 to 2024, and Belonging is his 32nd release. While the repertoire between the two records is identical, each release is distinct, best exemplified by his blur of funky stutter-step rhythms on The Wind-Up. Young drum sensation Justin Faulkner is the session wild card. Yes, he's a beast, confirmed Marsalis, but we never spent any time worrying about how we would make our performance different than those guys in Jarrett's band. I played in a youth trad band, he continues. I played in a couple of brass bands. I played in an R&B band, so I had some expectations that the saxophonist Jan Gabarek and the Scandinavians in Jarrett's band probably didn't have, because all of us in my band grew up listening to different styles of music. There was an attitude we could bring to that music. I knew automatically that it would be different than what was on the original record. Indeed, both versions of Belonging kick ass, but they do so in contrasting ways. John Christensen, Jarrett's drummer, floats like a hummingbird, suggesting the pulse, but leaving pockets of emptiness. When Faulkner rolls and tumbles, however, there's no doubt where the beat lies. Meanwhile, Marsalis and Garbarek are both Hall of Fame improvisers on tenor and soprano sax, a stalwart presence for more than half a century on the German ECM label. Garbarek's metallic nasal tone is instantly recognizable on both horns. Marsalis, on the other hand, has cultivated distinct personalities on his instruments. His tenor signature is broad and muscular, inspired by the river-deep tradition of hard-swinging American-born saxophonists. And our soprano, Marsalis, resonates warmth rather than Gabarek's customary cool. Framed by a sweet vibrato reminiscent of jazz clarinet, masters of the past, Branford's straight horn possesses an organic wood grain quality. While the saxophones howl, the pianists hold that music together on both records, sketching harmonic roadmaps for everyone to follow. Jarrett, who suffered a pair of debilitating strokes in 2018, is a generational talent who defined the art of solo piano after 1970. If you are a serious jazz aficionado, you probably own a copy of the Cohn Concert on ECM, still the gold standard for the improvised piano concerts. Like Jarrett in his prime, Joey Calderazzo, Marsalis' bandmate since 1999, possesses chops galore and testifies like a country tent preacher on Belonging's up-tempo rave-ups. It's on ballads like the bittersweet title cut and Solstice, however, when Calderazzo melts your heart, favoring mood setting over pyrotechnics. Imagine piano notes cast as wind chimes tinkling in a mellow breeze. Unwittingly, perhaps, Calderazzo and Marsalis previewed the ever-present spirit of empathy on Belonging during their duets at Duke Chapel. Using minimal amplification, the notes were launched at floor level, then hung in the air, weightlessly spiraling into the ceiling, intertwined in ethereal echo. Beautiful music rendered in slow motion. The effect was tranquil, suggesting a certain timelessness. Parenthetically, folks, I've performed at that chapel a long time, and that's a very polite way of talking about the reverberation time. That was fun, man, Marsalis affirmed of that chapel show. Joey and I did a duo record a long time ago, and I did a solo saxophone record in Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. The delay in that room was about 7 seconds. Instrumental musicians, he continued, spend so much time developing whatever they think will be their instrumental niche. Sometimes they spend more time enforcing their niche rather than looking at their surroundings. Duke Ellington performed and recorded a concert of sacred music in Grace Cathedral. He understood how to write for the room. Mozart wrote an oratorio with a place like that in mind. I told Joey, we're just going to play the pretty stuff, man. We can't play all that busy stuff here. It'll just get lost. And that would have been against the spirit of what we were there for in the first place. If you missed that live performance in Durham by Marsalis Calderazzo, don't despair. The inspirational ballads on belonging possess a similar essence. It's the sound of hope and redemption, a musical salve to calm frayed nerves. It's true, jazz is often about the virtuosity of musicians, but not always. Marsalis, for one, does not underestimate the power of pretty music played from the heart. And once again, the album's title is Belonging, a new release on ECM Records. All right, I have no time to read any more articles in their completeness, but I'll just mention this article called This: The Man Can Dance. The North Carolina State team spotlights first male dancer. Reynolds Coliseum was packed to the gills when the North Carolina State dance team took the court on a February night. A wolf howl blasted through the loudspeaker, and then the dancers came to life with the bass notes of Million Dollar Baby, moving in perfect sync to the lyrics. Do it, baby, do what I should think. Do it, baby, do what I could think. Clad in the staple of sports entertainment, black leggings, sparkly midriff-bearing sports bras, and bright red lipstick, they took a final leap and finished in a half split. One dancer stood out, Ryan Cawley, a first year on the 36-member dance team. He had the same smooth moves, but wore black pants and a black and red stylized T-shirt with the word PACK. And my music tells me that we are about to fade out on you. John Federson reminds you that this broadcast, like all of our Indie Week broadcasts, independent, can be found on our podcast section of ncreadingservice.org at your discretion whenever you want to listen to them. And also, again, a reminder, indieweek.com, your source for all of these articles, is available for free over the internet. I hope you'll be with us next week for The Independent. And so long from John Federson and your North Carolina Reading Service.